This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Head out to a nightclub in Lawrence this month, and you could be getting more than your typical shot of Fireball. That's because starting this weekend, city officials will be setting up vaccine clinics outside popular hotspots in a move to get as many shots in arms as possible. Meanwhile, you might spy people with coolers walking around in central Massachusetts carrying vaccines instead of cold beverages. They are both part of the latest strategy to reach holdouts in a state where roughly 30% of residents remain unvaccinated. With us to talk more about this effort is Kendris Vasquez. He's the mayor of Lawrence, and also Dr. John Broach. He's an emergency physician and runs a mobile vaccine clinic for UMass Memorial Healthcare. Mayor Vasquez, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
And Dr. Broach, thank you for joining us. So, Mayor Vasquez, I'm going to start with you. I want you to put us in your head for a minute. You've decided to put hot spot vaccines, right, outside of nightclubs. You're doing block parties. What was the moment in your head where you were like, yeah, this is what we've got to do now?
So I've always had a strong effort to get the vaccines to where people are. And, you know, block parties have proven to be successful and people continue to go to nightclubs. So let's bring the vaccine to where people are. But not just that, also, you know, this is all about accessibility. You know, in the city of Lawrence, it's important that everyone gets vaccinated and we have to make the vaccine accessible wherever people are.
Tell me about the block parties, because I know those have started. Are they working? What kind of numbers are you seeing?
Yeah, so we've seen very good success with these block parties. We are having a summer series in which we're going to have block parties at different points throughout the city. We had a big one in the Campanian Common in which we were able to vaccinate over 115 people, and 400 people actually showed up. So that's more than 25% of what we had anticipated. And that was our initial block party. So the idea of having, you know, multiple block parties throughout the city came exactly from that, because we saw the success and we believe that this is the way to do it, to give people access to the vaccine in all of the neighborhoods in the city of Lawrence.
And before I turn to Dr. Broach, is there some resident that sticks with you? You met them at the block party or you talked to them at some point as you were thinking about strategies that are why you're doing it this way now?
So I think this is all a data-driven process. It's about ensuring that we identify who needs a vaccine. And I'm speaking specifically about the age group. In the city of Lawrence, we're looking at the numbers, and the data tells us that it's individuals under the age of 30 that are getting vaccinated. So it is important that we find creative ways to get that population of our city vaccinated and meet them where they are. The block parties has proven effective for under the 18 population, and we are aiming to be able to have a positive impact among the 21 to 29 year olds by going to the nightclubs, which is the places where they're presently going to.
Okay, let me turn to Dr. Broach for a minute. You have been running mobile vaccine clinics in central Massachusetts. You've been doing it since the winter. What does that look like? I know you told our producer, Amanda Bieland, about people walking around with coolers. How does this actually work?
Yeah, great question, and congratulations, Mayor Vasquez, on the efforts you have there. You may want to take some of those ideas here to Central Mass too. But to your point, we've been doing this since February, and it's basically been anybody that we can find in anywhere that they are. So as the mayor said, we're meeting people where they are and trying to be sensitive to all the barriers that they may have to obtaining a vaccine or to obtaining information about a vaccine. And sometimes all it takes is for one of our clinicians to be able to give them some information, reassurance, and data, and really have a discussion with them in a place and a time and in a way that's comfortable for them and reassuring to them. So we've been in beauty salons, on buses, on street corners, and in businesses all around central Massachusetts, as well as in people's homes and senior centers and other places, and finding ways to, like I said, just contact people where they are, where they feel comfortable, and make the shot and the information about it.
So I'm standing at the bus stop and a clinician walks up to me and approaches me about getting a vaccine. We have a conversation. Do I wind up with a shot in my arm at the bus stop if I say yes?
Absolutely. That's the idea, is that we want to be able to have the vaccine available right at that point of attack where we've seen the patient and have gotten them the information. We typically will set up at a specific location. For example, our team is out today at a beauty salon, and as we realize that we'll have doses that aren't going to be able to be filled for people who are actually at the salon, we will start walking around the neighborhood, knocking on doors, standing on street corners, flagging down cars, asking them to pull over and give us a few minutes of their time to talk about the vaccine, and then have the vaccine right there ready to administer, observe them as is required, and then send them on their way with all the appropriate information.
Have you had a chance to talk someone into getting a shot?
Yeah. So early on and continuing till now, we, for example, we were up in Lemonster one day, and we were doing some vaccinations in a community center. We realized that we'd have a few extra and that we wanted to be out in the community. So a couple of colleagues and I walked to the street and flagged down a car. Patient who said that he really hadn't considered getting it, but we were able to give him some information, some literature about the vaccine. And at the end of the day, we gave him the Johnson & Johnson shot and observed him, and he was on his way.
You flagged down a car. Like, just... Wow.
Absolutely. Whatever it takes. That's our approach. Is, you know, if people are there, if we can find them, we're willing to give a shot just about anywhere that's safe.
So, Mayor Vasquez, what's your reaction to that? Flagging down cars, sitting in beauty parlors, catching people at bus stops.
That is something that I feel that he has been to the city of Lawrence. That's exactly what we're doing. We are, you know, bringing the vaccine literally door to door to the, you know, barbershops, hair salons, the restaurants, and now to nightclubs. And we have a strong collaboration with the churches. And, you know, this effort has actually yielded the city of Lawrence to, for the seventh week in a row, outpace the state in the vaccination efforts. You are bringing the vaccine literally everywhere, to the houses, to the churches, to the parks, convenience store, and nightclubs.
So, Dr. Broach, and Mayor Vasquez, you're welcome to answer this too. Is it the proximity, the being in the moment, or is it the information, the questions that you can answer that people aren't getting answers? What is the primary driver of success with this approach?
I think it's a mixture of...
Go ahead, Doctor. Oh, go ahead, Mayor. Sorry.
So I think that it's a mixture of different things. You know, having accessibility to the vaccine is definitely critical, but also having access to you know, factual information is critical, and having a clinician, having a pharmacist be able to respond to those questions gives people assurance that the vaccine is safe. But also the accessibility is critical. In a city like Lawrence, you do understand a lot of our folks, they have two jobs, and, you know, it might become inconvenient for you to actually set yourself some time to go get the vaccine, because you have to get from one place to another relatively quickly. So bringing it to them is critical.
Go ahead, Dr. Broach, add to that.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think the mayor is exactly right. It's a little bit of both. And I think one of the biggest components of our program and many others like it is the focus on equity and addressing the barriers that people have, both structural with related to their employment, language, their preferred language, as well as information. So, for example, we were a few weeks ago out at the Little Leaf Lettuce Farm up in Shirley, Massachusetts, vaccinating people at change of shift. Those are folks that didn't have an easy way to get down to one of the larger vaccination sites. We're not primarily English-speaking patients, and we had dual language providers there who could explain information about the vaccine in their own language and also fit it into their workday and make sure that they were able to continue to do the things they needed to provide for their families, but also get the vaccine and stay safe.
So, Mayor Vasquez, what are the concerns that your clinicians are hearing most from people? Why are young people, we talked about the logistics, but if there are concerns information-wise, what are they?
So I think that a lot of it has to do with the accessibility of it. You know, and with all the honesty, the younger population oftentimes do not trust the government. So that's why we are having, you know, these conversations, candid conversations with them where they are. And so that's what we are exactly doing. We're following the data, understanding that, you know, this is an age group that we need to communicate with, and we are doing so everywhere we are.
And Dr. Broach, lettuce farm, right? Do you call a lettuce farm and say we want to come there, or does the lettuce farm call you, the beauty salon, or the nightclub in particular in Lawrence that's going to have people outside? How does that happen, Dr. Broach?
It's a great question. We have a really talented team of what we call vaccine navigators who all have deep roots in the community and have lots of contacts in different segments of the community, both different language groups and different ethnic groups. One of our vice presidents at UMass, Monica Lowell, is really tied into the community around central Massachusetts, so has reached out through her contacts and identified these places, employers that are interested. Employers have been a big source of interest for us. And basically just making the service available and saying, look, we want your employees to be safe. We want your citizens to be safe. We want your church members to be safe. Can we work with you? Can we partner with you? And then once we've made that contact, really having that partner help us drive the messaging to the patients to at least get them in the door so that we can present the information has been super, super helpful.
Mayor Vasquez, one of the things that I think about in talking to the two of you, you are both committed and you're thoughtful and you're excited and inspired. We've heard conversations here on this show and elsewhere of compassion fatigue, of people losing their patience, of people getting frustrated. Have you lost your patience or gotten frustrated at all with those who have not gotten vaccinated yet? Or are you just finding that this grassroots, one person at a time, keeps the motor running and makes you feel inspired?
With all the honesty, I feel inspired every day when I see the effort is actually paying off. So just getting one person vaccinated one at a time, it's significant enough. And that keeps us going here in the city of Lawrence. We are focused on those that are, receiving the message and, trying to find creative ways to get to those that have not gotten the message yet and need additional information. So no, on the contrary, we feel very motivated in our city to continue this fight because this is the right fight for, the right reasons right now.
And Dr. Broach, how about you? Have you been able to keep that heart, or are there moments where you get fatigued, you get frustrated?
Certainly fatigued, but I agree with the mayor. Every time that we put a shot in an arm, that's a motivating moment. And every time we see somebody turn the corner and say, okay, you know what, I recognize that this is important to keep me safe, my family safe, my community safe, that's a moment that sticks with me. And that's the things we focus on. And the other great thing is that we have an amazing team with our mobile vaccine equity enhancement program. Our mobile team that are just so committed, are out literally every 5 days a week doing these vaccines and a lot of times on the weekends and evenings. And we all sort of inspire each other, I think, because we know how important this is.
Dr. Broach, anything you wish you had that you don't?
I think everybody always wishes they had more time, more resources, but we're really out there doing the real hand-to-hand, person-to-person work that that makes this happen, and so we're just going to continue to do that.
And Mayor Vasquez, if somebody wants to find out what nightclub the vaccines are going to be at or where the next block party is, how do they get that information?
Sure. They can visit our website, cityoflawrence.com/backlawrence. There you'll be able to get all of the information, not just in reference to the block parties and the nightclubs, but also all the different pop-ups that we have throughout the city.
And listeners, we'll also have that link on our website at radioboston.org. That's Kendris Vasquez, the mayor of Lawrence, and Dr. John Broach. He's an emergency physician and runs a mobile vaccine clinic for UMass Memorial Healthcare. Thanks so much to both of you. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time. Take care.
The $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure package has a lot in it, and potentially a lot for Massachusetts. Senator Ed Markey's office says the Commonwealth is set to receive about $8 billion to improve highways and public transit. And that made us wonder how much $8 billion really is in the grand scheme of things. I mean, it's a lot of money. But when it comes to roads, bridges, rails, is it? And the best way to spend it, what is that if the bill gets signed by the president? So we called up an old friend of the show and a longtime transit advocate, former Massachusetts Governor Mike Dukakis. And he began by telling us how he's thinking about that $8 billion.
Well, it's never enough. I mean, I will get into that in some detail, but it's an important major step forward. It's not just for Massachusetts, but it's for New England, because this has got to be a New England-wide and northeastern effort to get us into the 21st century, and to do so preferably not only with good highways and bridges and that kind of stuff, but preferably with a first-class rail passenger system that serves all of New England and connects us to the Northeast Corridor and the rest of the country. and lots of projects out there that people have been working on for some time. The one that isn't getting enough attention, in my opinion, is the North-South Rail Link, which both I and Governor Weld have been strongly supporting for a long time. We've got a 400-mile corridor in the Northeast Corridor stretching from Maine to Washington, D.C., with a one-mile hole in the middle of it in downtown Boston. And so, not only does that make no sense at all if you're serious about modern high-speed rail, but that project alone would take 60,000 to 70,000 cars off the road in metropolitan Boston every day.
Could this bill get us there? Is it the kind of trigger to get us over the hump that we need?
It certainly can, but the state's leadership has got to take this very seriously. And unfortunately, we are not getting the kind of support that I would like to have seen from Governor Baker and his administration when it comes to this particular project. And it's just so critical. I mean, isn't this absurd? A one-mile hole in the middle of a 400-mile rail corridor and the most popular and the most heavily used part of the entire Amtrak system. So I hope we can convince everybody that the North-South Rail Link is an essential part of this. There certainly are the resources to do it, no question about it.
What else do we need to do with that $8 billion?
Take a look at the region's needs and essentially complete a first-class rail passenger system. For example, east-west. Do we go all the way to the Berkshires? Well, that's an interesting question, but at a minimum, we ought to have excellent rail service, not just from Boston to Worcester, but Boston to Worcester to Springfield. And folks in the western part of the state want that very badly, and it's essential for their future. So that's an important thing. South Coast Rail, good Lord, how long is it going to take us to connect the folks in New Bedford, Fall River, and Taunton, and that part of the state, with Boston by rail? That's an essential part.
So that's all rail, Governor Dukakis. I think about all the conversations we've had in the last couple of years about changes we need to make to our highway system to better manage traffic congestion. I get improving rail is a key part of doing that. Questions about bridges and infrastructure, things falling
all
apart on us.
But you won't make much progress by expanding highway capacity. We know that. Why? Because as soon as you build a project, it fills up with more cars. This has got to be an essentially rail-oriented approach. And if we do that, we'll not only reduce congestion dramatically, but we'll serve a lot of communities in this state that need and want excellent rail connections. And we're ready to go in this. I mean, there's no secret mystery about this. We know what we have to do, South Coast Rail, East-West, North-South Rail Link. Those are the key projects. Now, we also have got New England partners who need some rail improvement as well. New Hampshire to Boston, for example, is important. The western part of the state can be well served by rail improvements. So it's not that I don't think we've got to improve our bridges and that kind of thing, but we know that adding highway capacity just doesn't work.
So, you've painted an urgent picture here about a lot of infrastructure investment in rail, which I know has long been a key area for you. You were on the board of Amtrak, for example,
right,
for our listeners who may not know. I look at this bill. It's made it through the Senate during a time when, boy, is it hard to get anything done in Congress, it seems, from watching. It faces really still a fight because the House is not willing to take it up until they've pushed through another $3.5 trillion spending package that the Senate doesn't want. What does it feel as a former governor from a different era to watch this play out in Congress? And can this bill get finished?
Well, first, none of these things are easy. On the other hand, we heard all about infrastructure from the former president day after day, week after week. He never got anything done. We're on the verge of doing very important things right now with bipartisan support. And my hat's off to the Republicans as well as the Democrats that have worked so hard to get this legislation and get these projects moving. There's more to be done. And my hope is that folks across the political spectrum will see and understand that. I think they do. I think they do, and I think that's the reason that so many of us feel so good about the fact that Congress has acted or will be acting, certainly the Senate, and the House on this. So I'm quite optimistic, to tell you the truth. I think this is a great opportunity for us. It puts people to work, creates good jobs, and more than that, dramatically improves the quality of life for the people of Massachusetts and of New England and the Northeast.
So not to put too fine a point on it, but House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said the House is not going to pass this bill that came out of the Senate until they also pass and the Senate passes a larger reconciliation package, this $3.5 trillion bill that takes a much more broad and differently centered look at infrastructure. That could be a real throwdown, and it could lead to this smaller infrastructure package not getting passed. Do you agree with that strategy, and what does it mean for the Commonwealth if it doesn't get passed?
Well, I don't think we have an option here. I don't think we've got any alternative. We've got to move on this. This is a very, very important step forward. Can we get the broader package? Yes, I think we probably can, but it's going to be tougher. But in the meantime, I think it would be a mistake to essentially sacrifice what has been a very impressive bipartisan effort to wait to get a much more expanded package. I know that's what the Speaker would like to do. I admire for it. I support it. But in the meantime, let's get cracking on this thing. Let's get people to work, and let's give ourselves a modern transportation system. I mean, it's really kind of embarrassing. You go to Europe, if you go to the Far East, you're on high-speed trains that are moving all over the place and carrying millions of people. And we're just kind of trailing along here. That's not the American way, it seems to me.
So,
and this is a great opportunity to do it.
So I hear you, and you've laid out what the money can do for us. As I listen to you talk about what we need to do and how long it's been important to do it with the various rail packages that you're talking about, I find myself wondering, what about the political will to do it? Let's say the $8 billion is on the table. You've already said that you're concerned about not enough leadership here in the state. Is the political will there to use this money in the ways that you are laying out?
I think the answer to that question is yes, and I think it's going to be very difficult to not take advantage of what is a long overdue opportunity to give us a first-class modern transportation system. And I think you'll see folks on both sides of the aisle moving to make that happen. Sure, there are going to be some holdouts, but I'm impressed with the effort that has been made already. I think it's going to continue, and I'm quite optimistic about this.
Okay, so then two prognostications. One, when does this bill become law? This year?
Oh, sure.
And two, when do we see the rail vision that you're imagining on the ground after this bill gets passed?
That depends on the ability of the state's transportation agency and other states' transportation agencies to move and move quickly and effectively. There's no excuse with this kind of opportunity. There's no excuse for delay. There's no excuse for bureaucratic stumbling around here. We know what we've got to do. It's time we did it.
That was former Massachusetts Governor Mike Dukakis. Anyone trying to buy a home right now can tell you it is painful out there. Prices are high. Competition is fierce. WBUR's Simone Rios followed one home buyer through that odyssey on Morning Edition today, and we want to pick up the thread now. How did things get so bad? Will they improve, and what will that take? A little later in the conversation, we will take your calls. The phones are already ringing. We want to know, are you having trouble buying a home? Tell us your stories. Maybe you need advice. Ask. And if you're relocating, have your preferences changed since the start of the pandemic? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. We will pick up with you in a bit, but first, we want to welcome Mark Drayson, Executive Director of the Metropolitan Area Planning Council, to give us a bit of the big picture. Mark, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here, Tiziana.
So on a scale from normal to nuts, Mark, how would you describe the state of the Greater Boston housing market right now?
Well, we're pretty close to nuts. I mean, we were having a housing crisis and an emergency on the homeownership and the rental side before the pandemic. It cooled down for a while. We did see rents go down, particularly in certain parts of the region. And then it came back with a vengeance starting about 3 months ago. And honestly, I've been in this field for 40 years now. This is the hottest housing market and the most difficult housing market to get into that I've ever seen in my career.
So what do you worry about when this plays in your head? I'm assuming, maybe I'm projecting, a pit in your stomach. What are you worrying about?
Well, that pit's been in my stomach for a while, but it hurts a little more right now. The thing I worry about most is the economic future of the region. You know, we're kind of lucky. People want to live here. People want to move here from other parts of the country and other parts of the world. That's a good thing. Like many of your listeners, I lived through a period of disinvestment here in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. And disinvestment is a lot worse. It's a lot worse when people don't want to move into your area, and home prices are falling, and you see vacant and boarded up apartments. Right now, we're dealing with a good problem, which is that people want to live here and people want to move here. You just have to have enough homes for them to buy or rent. And we have been limiting supply now for decades. We don't build enough houses. We don't build enough rental, enough condos, enough single-family homes. And the result is that we're pricing ourselves out of that market. I know from my own experience that members of my staff have left to move to other states where it's easier to buy a home. And we see that happening in the private sector and even in the public sector all over this region. That's the thing I worry about the most.
Mark, you said just a second ago that we have been limiting our supply for decades. Simone Rios, our colleague, reported this morning that single-family home supply is down 50% over last summer, condos down 38%. That's in a year. Building takes longer than that. Why else are we seeing this sort of strangling of the supply? Or is it not unusual to see a 50% reduction in supply year over year?
Well, the level of change is the level of limitation and the level of change in supply is a little bit unusual, but we've been seeing this pattern for decades here in Greater Boston. Most land use decisions belong with local cities and towns. And unfortunately, many of those communities, not all, but many of those communities intentionally try and limit supply. They don't want too many people moving in. They don't want more kids in the schools. There are also, we really have to recognize this. We have to own up to it. There are racial and social and class reasons for this as well. And so you have many communities in the region not allowing multifamily housing anywhere in their community. Other communities technically allow it, but then they say things like the city council or town meeting needs to approve every single new development, which is kind of equivalent to saying there will be no more development. And if you don't build enough rental housing, it has a pernicious effect on home ownership as well. Because then senior citizens who might want to downsize to a condo or rental apartment, they can't find one in the community where they've lived, the community they love. So they stay put in their single family home for an extra 5, 10, 15 years. And that home with plenty of bedrooms isn't available to a young family.
Go ahead, finish your thought.
The rental market and the home ownership market are really connected. If you want to moderate prices, not even bring them down tremendously, but just moderate them, you have to build more single-family homes, especially smaller ones. You have to build more condos, and you must build more rental housing, and not in just one part of the region, but throughout the region.
So back in January, the Commonwealth passed a $626 million omnibus bill. It included Governor Baker's housing choice, which changes zoning law so that municipalities can pass zoning changes with a simple voting majority rather than a two-thirds majority. Now, some people's eyes will glaze over on zoning, but that has the potential, as I understand it, to make a big difference in loosening up housing restrictions in cities and towns. That's what, 8 months ago now? Have we seen any benefit from that? Do you anticipate seeing any benefit from that?
Well, it will take some time, but we've already begun to see benefit from it. I have seen communities that have passed new zoning ordinances allowing for more housing production or allowing for what we call accessory dwelling units, allowing for multifamily housing since that law passed. It was definitely a good idea to bring us into sync with most of the rest of the country to say that these zoning ordinances could be approved by a simple majority rather than by two-thirds. That bill also included an important requirement that communities in the MBTA district must have at least one district of reasonable size for multifamily housing development. It will take longer to implement that part, but the state is developing regulations, and my hope is that we will see additional supply come out from, you know, as a result of that. Housing choice was a very good step in the right direction. Congratulations to Governor Baker for putting it forward and the legislature for passing it. But it is only a first step. There are a lot more things we need to do to create more units, to create more supply, and especially to create affordable units. You know, it has taken us 20, 30 years of limited development to get into this pickle. We can't only get out of it by increasing supply. We have to produce units that are truly affordable. That requires more subsidy. And we even need to have what I like to call an adult conversation about limitations on rents in certain circumstances.
All right. Well, we have talked about limitations on rents, also known as rent control, previously on Radio Boston. My guess is we're going to have that conversation again, especially because it's an issue in the Boston's mayor's race. That was Mark Drayson of the Metropolitan Area Planning Council. Mark, thanks for coming on the show. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Okay, again, that number, listeners, 1-800-423-8255 to join this conversation. The calls are coming in. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. I just want to bring in the guests who are going to help us with these calls next. We have Realtor and Chief Sustainability Officer of Layer Realty Partners, Craig Foley, and Greg Vassell, CEO and President of the Greater Boston Real Estate Board. Craig, welcome.
Thank you.
Greg, welcome.
Good afternoon.
And let's just acknowledge I may mess that up once, but I'm going to try not to. Craig and Greg, it's good to have both of you.
Great to be here.
Okay, so I'm actually going to grab a couple of calls right off the board, Craig and Greg, and then we're going to jump into our conversation. You good with that?
Sounds good.
All right, Barbara's on the line in Georgetown, Massachusetts. Barbara, go ahead.
Hi. So I've been looking for a single-family home for a year and a half now. I sold my other home and I've been living in an apartment right before COVID hit, is this all started. And I have not been able to find, and I'm talking about a three-bedroom home, one and a half bath, something small, nothing major, that's, you know, reasonable quality. And I feel like the houses, I've moved many times in my life, I feel like the housing quality is not there for the dollar amount to be asking, like $625 for a ranch from the 1950s that's had very little done to it, rather just a Home Depot kitchen and bathroom, maybe one of those plastic cover-up things over the bathroom. Nothing major done, and they're asking exorbitant amount of money for it. They don't want you to do any kind of inspection, no contingencies, all kinds. And I can come in with cash and have no contingencies, and yet I still cannot find any value.
Okay. So I'm going to stop you there, Barbara. I really appreciate your call. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you just hit like 8 points that I think are key in this conversation, and I want to give our guests a chance to weigh in. Craig, how typical is what we're hearing from Barbara?
Well, that's a pretty typical story. There's no question. I feel Barbara's pain. There's no question about it. That is exactly the price point that it is the toughest spot in the marketplace right now. I mean, unfortunately, or fortunately for home sellers, very tough market for home buyers. But you know, that is a price point where people are just driven to. And that is the price point where we're seeing multiple offers all of the time. Now, Barbara's in a great situation in that she's a cash buyer, so that there's certainly an advantage there. And there are a lot of cash buyers out there right now that, you know, make the traditional home buyer, even with 20% down, but if you're putting down 5 or 10% at that price point, it's very difficult to land a property. I would say for Barbara, something to consider, and I understand her point absolutely, that, you know, she's worried about the value, buying in this marketplace, but the market is a place, as Mark said in the previous segment, we're lucky to be in an area of the country where people want to be. So buying the, you know, quote unquote, not so good house and making improvements to it over time so that you can increase your equity is something that we guide people to look at this point.
Craig, I'm going to pick it up from you there. I want to turn to Greg for a second. I hear Craig, and I just want everyone to know the lines are just blowing up. So we'll go back to calls in a minute. But Greg, oh my gosh, cash in this market,
yes,
waiving contingencies. I mean, at one level, you want to say, who can even do that? And what will it mean for our economy long term when these are the burdens of home ownership, home purchasing in our communities?
Well, it's a stark reality. And I sort of harken back to what Mark Drayson just said. It's the result of many decades of non-production of the kind of housing stock that we needed. You know, we need developers to be building more of the kind of housing stock that was built after World War II for the returning GIs. Three-bedroom, one-and-a-half-bath homes that people can afford to get into. Smaller house-size lots. You know, that's the sort of stuff that, that people need to start. And Barbara was looking at a 1950s ranch with not too much work on it. You know, some of those capes from the 1940s and 50s fall right into that sweet spot.
All right, let's go back to the phones here. Thanks for that, Greg. 1-800-423-8255 to join the conversation. We've got Bruce on the line in Roxbury. Bruce, go ahead.
Hi. It's good to be on. My name is Bruce Marks. I'm the CEO of NACA. So, you know, we've been doing this for 35 years in terms of providing mortgages to low and moderate income people. So anybody that comes through NACA gets a no down payment, no closing costs loan. And today's rate is 2% for a 30-year fixed, 1.25% for a 15-year. But the point I want to make, and I agree with what's being said, in that we got to build affordable housing. But the also good thing that, you know, what Mark was talking about and what your guests are, is that, you know, there's a lot of developers out there that are building the high-end properties. We should, and they require variances. They require them in Boston. They require them where they want to build. And we should require them to have 50% of the units that they are developing be affordable housing.
Okay, Bruce,
because
I'm going to take it from you there. Thank you, Bruce. And again, we have so many people who want to have a conversation here. The mortgage thing that Bruce is bringing up, I do wonder about that. And Craig, I've been thinking about the Great Recession and what we learned about mortgage products that were sort of feeding a frenzy. And we see this buying frenzy now. Not everybody can go cash only. Do people have access to the mortgages they need? And what does that do to housing equity, especially given our history of redlining in this country?
Those are great questions. Those are great questions. And Bruce had some great comments, too, that I'd like to just give a gentle pushback to. So I work with developers. And, you know, let's not forget that the same issues that Barbara has in terms of buying housing or buying lots or buying land to be able to develop, developers are dealing with that also. Very, very expensive prices. And on top of that, they have the risk going through COVID, where they couldn't get permits signed off on, where their carrying costs were extended. The risk, I know developers aren't the most favorited people on the face of the earth, but there's a lot of risk in developing property. And I have to say, if we went to 50% affordable without any kind of density bonuses, and perhaps that's what Housing Choice will be able to provide, it would be impossible. You wouldn't have development happen at this region. I know that many people think development, you know, the developers just make all kinds of money, hands over fists. I can honestly say that that is not the case, that there is a ton of risk involved.
So, Greg, let me bring Greg in here. Greg, do you agree with Craig? I can imagine the listener out there that's saying, I want to push back on that, because there always is. Do you agree with what Craig is saying there, Greg, and any way to shade that we should know?
Well, yeah, I totally agree with what Craig said, because the difficulty with development is it's easier to build for the higher end of the market, because when you look at land costs, soft costs, hard costs, the cost of, you know, materials and permitting and everything else, you end up with a really high number. And then when you look at what you got for a number and what you have to sell it for, it's automatically at the higher end. I mean, and then the inclusionary zoning stuff is great and trying to build a high percentage of affordable, but some part of your development has to bear those burdens. And if you put it at such a high number, it just doesn't cash flow and the deal's not going to happen.
So much of this, Greg, is focused on building. What about existing housing stock? Is there something that we can or should be doing differently with existing housing stock to encourage more of it onto the market?
Well, what you might think of is some of the bigger, older homes, maybe there was a way to convert them into two families. Maybe the square footage in them is so large that you could actually, you know, we built a lot of multifamily housing. You know, when you look at the Worcesters and the Lowells and the Lawrences, the twos and the threes, those were really good family homes. And if you were in one of those units, there was a lot of room to live in and raise a family. You know, maybe we should think about building more product like that. Yeah, the backyards are smaller, and yeah, the streets are tighter, but you could put a lot of families together, and it was built for a time really when people could walk to work from the neighborhoods that they lived in. And we're looking to lower our carbon footprint. Maybe we need to rethink that, and since we can work from home, maybe that's the way we go.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We've got Karen on the line in Easton. Karen, go ahead.
Hi, I just sold my house for twice as much as I bought it for 20 years ago. But going out and trying to find another house has been absolutely impossible, even though I have twice as much money to deal. Well, I sold it for $159 20 years ago, and I just sold my house for $330 cash. They put it off for a month and a half. I'm going crazy, but I was very happy with that amount. But going out, all I can afford is a house with like 400 to 800 square feet, the houses I've been seeing. If I want to have money left over to go visit my grandbabies who are in Florida and Manhattan, I cannot do it. Also, I have a comment about HOA fees.
Karen, I'm going to skip the HOA fees. Thank you. But the first point that you had is central to this conversation. So let's pick up on that. You know, this supply and demand crunch that we are in, Craig, and preparing for this today, I read quite a bit about the fact that if someone does put a house on the market, they may not have another house they can afford to go to. Is that suppressing the kind of churn that might loosen up the market a little bit?
Absolutely. The average time for home sellers to sell used to be in the 7 to 10 year range, and that's, you know, now 12 to 15 years. That's a problem in the marketplace. And of course, in Greater Boston, you know, we have an ocean to the east, so we can't build there. So development has moved further north, west, south, and it's increased prices everywhere. So you have to go further and further outside the 128, 495 corridors to be able to get something that's affordable. I think the solution here, it's already been said a bunch of times, starting with Mark and what Greg's already said, is we really have to creatively think, you know, new zoning options out there for communities to allow development to happen. I think that's the only solution. I think MAPC, I remember in 2014, produced a study that said we need 400,000 housing units in Greater Boston by 2040 just to sustain the growth that we have in our economy. We need creative solutions at this point.
And MAPC being the Massachusetts Area Planning Council, which
correct.
Mark Dreesen is with. So, Greg, yeah. I want to come back to you here. When we're in a fixed pie situation, right, that means by definition there are going to be winners and losers. Are we in a fixed pie situation here? And if we are, which communities are winning in this market and which communities in Massachusetts are losing?
Well, I think it depends how you define winning. Because there'll be communities, I think, in the long term, as Craig mentioned, that will win if they think of creative ways to bring people into their communities, because they'll bring in not only diversity, but new sort of intellectual power, new opportunities for retail and restaurants and different things. You know, as we bring more people in, we need to have communities be creative and thinking of new ways to create places for people to live and work. The communities that are sort of stodgy, don't want to change, want to keep the one-acre zoning and just keep things the way they are, you know, that's not going to fly in the new world that we're in. And I don't think that's where people are going to want to live. I think gone are the days of the long driveways and the big commutes. I just think we need to be have a different approach.
So we have a caller who I'm not going to have time to get to, who raises a question that we've heard a lot of conversation about, which is where you have luxury housing, buyers purchasing that housing because it's an investment for their money, not necessarily living in it, and driving up overall housing prices. That's a conversation we've been having in Boston for at least 5-10 years now. Craig, is that a concern, or Greg, whoever feels like they want to take this one on? And short-term rentals, the way they are changing who buys and sells and why we hold properties. Are there other structural issues here we haven't been talking about that maybe need to be brought into the picture? Craig, maybe you first.
Well, Greg has, I'm sure, some answers for this. I prefer he pick.
Let's
this
do it, Greg.
First.
Go ahead.
Well, I think that people should realize that real estate is a wonderful investment, and that people feel that there's more safety there than maybe in other investments like the stock market, and certainly returns on their money for banks. So, I mean, I think it's difficult as a free market economy to try to regulate who can buy and who cannot buy particular homes. I mean, we just talked a little bit a while ago about redlining. So do we go out and say just because somebody happens to have disposable cash and wanted to buy an investment property or to buy, you know, a unit? I mean, we see this in the city all the time. Somebody has a kid that's going to school here in Boston. They buy a unit. That person is a student, lives there for 4 or 5 years, and they keep it as a rental property. I mean, I think that's a good thing because it helps, you know, mean that the community is a desirable place to live.
So I'm going to come back to you now, Craig. We're starting to run short on time, and I'm just mindful, you know, in all these calls, we heard the sense of urgency. We heard the sense of frustration from our callers. How are you, I don't mean this pejoratively, but how are you holding buyers' hands right now, and what kind of guidance are you giving them? This is a rough, rough time to be trying to put your family in a home that you own.
Well, the tricky part with buyers is, you know, we end up being marriage counselors as well, Tiziana, in this process, as you can imagine. And it's very tough for them to make decisions. And our job as realtors, they're our clients. We have to do what they want to do. So we give them as much information as they want to make, and they make the decisions about their offer price. And typically, you know, that's a process that goes through several multiple offers where they learn the market. I've learned as a realtor in the business for 21 years, you know, hopefully, you know, all my clients, and they do, ask me what they think the chances are of landing the deal, and I will give that to them with the offer that they're giving. But I'm not going to force anyone to make any decisions that they don't want. They have to learn the market on their own. So working with a buyer is hard. It's a lot of work, and it takes time, and it's multiple offers. It's seeing a bunch of different properties, and you feel their pain through the entire process. A good realtor, and there's so many of them out here in this marketplace, you know, it is really respectful of that, I think.
All right. That is Craig Foley. He is Realtor and Chief Sustainability Officer of Layer Realty. We've also had Greg Vassell, CEO and President of the Greater Boston Real Estate Board. Greg, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Yeah.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, Amanda Beland, and Cynthia Betubiza. We had help from Ali Audette and Stephen Gelman. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.